History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, this is a special episode that I am doing with Steve Guerra. A year or two ago, Steve and I did this series called Hollywood Hates History, where we looked at the most historically inaccurate movies that Hollywood has produced. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of options to choose from, but we tried to find the diamonds in the rough, such as The Conqueror, the movie that stars John Wayne as Genghis Khan. And whatever exists in your imagination about how bad that would be, it's 10 times worse, believe us. Well, we're going to pick up this series. One we're going to look at is 1999's The Messenger, the story of Joan of Arc. This movie stars Mila Jovovich of The Fifth Element, the Resident Evil movies fame as Joan of Arc. Now, I would argue that she's miscast, but that's barely the first of this movie's problems. This movie follows the fringe historical theory that the Maid of Orleans wasn't following God's orders, or at least she fully believed to be following God's orders, but was actually a schizophrenic, and Mila Jovovich plays the character to form. So we discuss the few accuracies and the many inaccuracies of this film. And as we noted in the other Hollywood Hates History movies, there are always flaming arrows in these films for some reasons, maybe for dramatic license, even though arrows like these would be horribly inaccurate and due to all sorts of reasons of physics wouldn't hit their target. There are plenty of flaming arrows to be seen in this movie, along with many other problems. And by the way, if you haven't checked out Steve's podcast, Beyond the Big Screen, you definitely should, because he has an entire podcast devoted to stuff like this, looking at films, seeing how accurate, or for most of the time, inaccurate they are. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion.
Welcome back to another exciting and awesome episode of Hollywood Hates History. And boy, today, Hollywood definitely hates history. Scott Rank and I are back again, and we're going to look at The Messenger from 1999, all the way back to 1999. How's it going today, Scott?
Oh, it's going great, and it's gotten a lot better since I saw this movie. So, oh, wow. We have a major treat in store for everyone. Oh,
and this is going out to a special thank you to one of my longtime supporters and listeners, Peter. So Peter asked for this, and he's getting it today. So we're talking about The Messenger from 1999. It was directed by Luc Besson, and it stars Mila Jovovich, John Malkovich, Faye Dunaway, Vincent Cassel, and a weird cameo at the end by a very bearded Dustin Hoffman. So really, in short, the overview of the movie is another film adaptation of the Joan of Arc story. And it details the childhood. She sees some vision. She's pious to the extreme. Her village is destroyed. Family killed in a chevauchée-type a raid on her township by the English.
In a very tasteful scene, I might add.
Yeah, incredibly tasteful scene.
What you can say for the entire movie, really, tasteful.
Exactly. She meets the Dauphin, the heir apparent to the French crown, which is kind of akin to the Prince of Wales in the UK. Then there's the good old-fashioned story where she identifies Charles the Dauphin, even though she's never seen him. The Siege of Orléans, coronation of Charles at Reims, Siege of Paris, Charles has enough of Joan. Joan's captured at the Siege of Compiègne, tried for heresy, burned at the stake in Rouen for dressing like a guy or something. And that's pretty much, that's the movie in a nutshell. Is there anything I missed majorly in that synopsis?
Well, no, I think you got it, because for those, who know the story of Joan of Arc, this does hit the main beats. But when you mentioned this movie, I had never seen it before, but I knew of this movie and I was creating a movie in my brain. I thought, okay, it stars Mila Jovovich of all the Resident Evil movies. That's what she's known for. But she had her breakout Hollywood hit in The Fifth Element, also directed by Luc Besson, which is a delightfully bonkers, and I use the word bonkers in the best way possible when I'm talking about The Fifth Element sci-fi movie. This movie is bonkers in a different way, which I do not mean as highly complimentary, But in my brain, I thought, okay, so it's Alice, Resident Evil. She'll be doing backflips when she's fighting as Joan of Arc. Okay, it's set in a medieval context. Since The Lord of the Rings, everyone's been ripping off the imagery from the Siege of Rohan and the Siege of Gondor, so they'll have that kind of CGI. What else? It'll be kind of really period inaccurate, like that Taron Egerton Robin Hood movie that was horrible, where archers are moving around like SEAL Team 6. But this movie wasn't as bad in the ways I imagined, but probably only for the reason that this movie came out before all those other movies like Lord of the Rings or Resident Evil. So this movie was bonkers, but not as bonkers as I thought it would have been. That's what I would say from the outset.
And I'd probably have to add here that horses way left the barn on this one, but we're probably going to give spoilers.
Yeah. And should I mention Flaming Arrows? Or I guess that goes without saying in every movie we've seen, but we'll save that for later, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Save the best for later. We don't want to eat our cake right now, right, before we've completely dived into the main course. So really, the background of the movie is the Hundred Years' War. And this Joan of Arc is involved in the final phase of the war, and she comes in the real, like, 1,000-foot view of the Hundred Years' War is that it's a fight out between the Angevin kings of England, who want, or Plantagenet if you prefer, kings of England against the Valois kings of France. And each of them have their claims for the crown of France, and they basically duke it out for 120-ish odd years for who's going to be the king of France. And over the times, the English, they do very well throughout this entire war. And they're pretty much in this time period of Joan of Arc, it looks like they're going to win. They have a lot of allies amongst the local French duchies, the Burgundians, the Aquitanians. They're doing very well. And some of the key battles, there's Crecy, Poitiers, where the English just destroy the French, just completely destroy. There's a little bit of a break in the 1300s for the Black Death, and then we go on to the next. So there's a couple of different phases of it. Later in 1415, so only a very few years before the time that this movie sent, is the Battle of Agincourt, where the English archers just absolutely destroy the French aristocracy. I can't remember the numbers exactly, but it's like major dukes of this and that. They're all killed in this unbelievable battle. And believe it or not, I think Joan would have been born at this time if her dating accuracy is correct. She would have been alive and, you know, like a toddler during this battle.
Yeah, this is it's by far the low point of for France in the Hundred Years' War, perhaps in medieval French history. This is also the time of King Charles VI, who wasn't a great king for many reasons, partly because he thought he was made of glass, which doesn't help. His wife, Isabeau of Bavaria, essentially set things up so that the English would, after the Dauphine, would get the throne of France. So the court of France rules things, but things are very decentralized. Different dukes are vying for control, and the English exploit this really well.
So I thought maybe a good thing we could do is I made up a little timeline of Joan's life, and I thought maybe we could hit a couple of key points and then tie in the film and just see where this film runs amok.
Yes, it does.
She's born in 1412, and the movie doesn't say anything about her birth. It pretty much jumps right into her having these visions when she looks like she's maybe about 7. I don't know if they actually said it or not. But she's young. She's not quite a teenager yet. Maybe she is a teenager. It was hard to tell. But she has her first vision in real life when she's 13 years old. And in the movie, right about the time when she's having these visions, her town is raided by the English. In real life, it's raided by the Burgundians. And these raids, were you familiar about these raids? They were a pretty brutal affair during the Hundred Years' War. I didn't know much about it until I had read a book about the Hundred Years' War. They're called them chevauchées, where the English would just go through on a rampage and burn and sack towns. And then the French would pretty much come back and burn and sack through these same towns that the English had just gone through.
Not as much, but from what I gathered looking at Joan's life and seeing the context of, I mean, the war-torn nature of the French countryside, it sounds similar to like a Kentucky or a Missouri during the Civil War, where you have different, essentially guerrilla groups, and the dukedoms, the Burgundians and others aren't quite that, but the Burgundians, which would be nominally allied with the crown of France, don't seem to be in practice, and then sometimes are even closer to the English crown, wherever they can gain the most advantage. So for villagers that are sandwiched in between, like Joan was, it was a very dangerous environment to be in, to be sure.
Yeah, and there was really no France as such at that time. It was a collection of kingdoms. There was Aquitaine, Loire, these different duchies that would kind of add up. And sometimes they were, like you said, sometimes allies of France, sometimes not allies of France. The actual France itself was a very small area around Paris, which we'll learn through the movie is actually controlled by the King of England at that time. And the King of England is wearing both crowns, if you will. He's the King of England and the King of France. Now in 1428, when Joan's 16 years old, she goes to a local French leader to tell of her visions and her desire to see the Dauphin, who, in this local commander, he's like, oh yeah, okay, this 16-year-old girl wants to go see the heir apparent to the King of France. And yeah, I'm just going to go and escort her there, and she's going to go and conquer the English, who are basically kicking our butts all through everywhere throughout the country. There is that interesting scene, though, of the raid through Joan's town. Maybe you could set us up a little bit about that, looking at it through fresh eyes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it. So if you watch The Messenger, what, you know, Joan has set up is this very pious girl who comes to confess to the priest. And the criticisms I read of the film is that I suppose the Catholic Church is seen as being somewhat ineffectual and an antagonist to Joan. And she's trying to be pious in her own way, despite this roadblock. And the priest is hearing her confession, but saying, you're overdoing it. You don't really need to confess. Goes home, and then there's a raid by the English. The English attack. Joan hides, but her sister is raped and murdered, not in that order. So yeah. Again, very tasteful movie, listeners. But setting up, I guess, just a lot of really trying to play on your heartstrings there. So then Joan has a vision as a young girl, but it's not really of any saint in particular. She sees a child, and then it's images of the cloud and the sky. She sees a strange image of Christ, whereas the original Joan, she saw images of saints, Catherine of Alexandria, Margaret of Antioch, Michael the Archangel, and different histories make the point that she may have gotten the idea, and others may have told her that, well, Michael is the patron saint of the French royal army, so the means by which you're going to accomplish your command to help restore the British crown isn't lost to her. It's going to have to be done by military means. So that's one way she's pushed forward, but not explained very clearly in the movie. It's just where she gets some trippy psychedelic close up. You mentioned just lots of zooms and zoom ins to people's faces, and the trippiest and bonkers it gets in this movie is her visions, I would say.
Yeah, they go visions, the murder rape, and then she winds up somehow in the court of Charles VII. Like, they pretty much skip any like transition from those. And I mean, we'll get into this later, but I think that that's probably one of the really key missteps in this movie, as there's absolutely no transitions. It's just like, and maybe that's what he was going for, to make it really choppy. I don't know why you would want to make a movie super choppy, but it's like, she's got her visions. Boom. Next thing you know, she's in the court of Charles VII, who, like we were saying, he's pretty much completely surrounded in a town called Chinon, which is kind of near Paris, in that Paris-ish region, and that's all he's got, is this little section of land that's completely surrounded by his enemies. And at that same time, the city of Orléans is being besieged by the English. And this is where Joan's like big number comes in. But before we even go there, there's the most famous scene in Joan's life. What the movie skipped is that the local duke or something in her town, after she's basically pestered him to go see Charles VII, he lets her and has her escorted to Chinon. They want to see if everything that Joan has been saying is correct. and they have a fill-in for Charles, and Charles is off hiding someplace, and she can recognize that the person she's speaking to is not Charles and goes and finds the real Charles. And the movie shows that kind of well, very frenetically. I mean, Joan's got to go running around and screaming at people and everything. But so that was like a, I would say that I'd give that scene, that's fairly accurate. Then I think this is probably the best scene in the whole movie. If this whole movie was the Siege of Orleans, I would say that it was a really good movie. Maybe not historically accurate, but a good movie. Let's go to the Siege of Orleans. So basically the English have Orleans surrounded, and that's in real life and in the movie. But it's not the greatest siege. There's a lot of holes because the English, as much as they're riding on top, they don't have a lot of troops and a lot of resources to really throw at anything. I mean, you compare, I had read someplace that England had about maybe their economy was only about maybe 50% of France's, the whole English economy, and like their tax base and their ability to grow crops, etc. But the King of England was the king of all of England and controlled Wales and Ireland, I think Ireland at this time. And he was able to just use his resources more efficiently than the French. And that was kind of their, the English's advantage in this conflict, is that even though they didn't have as much to throw at anything, they were a lot more efficient and their strategy was a lot better than the French. The French had a lot to throw at things, but they just didn't do it very well. So at the Siege of Orleans, they're going to throw a lot at the English to try and break this siege. And, oh, where to begin in this siege? Where to begin?
Yeah, so it's sort of like the night before battle. They're denigrating her. Okay, the king is letting you join the military effort, but you're a woman, so we're not going to listen to you. And they start the battle without her. Well, yeah, go ahead and I guess you can start off the explanation of the movie, because then I agree, it's pretty good. Now, it does begin to diverge from the main narrative, and then not as wildly as it does in the second and third acts. But yeah, why don't you take it away?
I mean, the best part, I think, was very much in the beginning, they want to send a message to the English. Joan says she actually wants to speak to, I think, the leader of the English was Talbert or Tolbert, and I think that was fairly accurate. But so her message that she wants to send, now mind you, Joan is illiterate, so she's dictating these messages. And in the Middle Ages, I mean, I'm no medievalist, I'm no scholar, but the best way I can think of to sending a message is like Joan did. You tie it around an arrow, light the arrow on fire, and then shoot it at the enemy camp. I mean, that's how I would do it.
The postal system in the past is flaming arrows. I mean, flaming arrows really make up a lot of the ancient and medieval world. That's what movies have taught me.
I can't imagine that there'd be any problems with shooting a flaming arrow through the air with a piece of parchment or paper tied to it.
I agree. It makes perfect sense to me. Yeah.
And then the English, they get the letter. They have a good old laugh about it. But so that's the other thing. I'll give them credit for this. They had a lot of people, French actors, and they very much mixed up calling her Joan and Jean throughout the whole movie, which was nice. So Joan convinces them to attack, and they just do an all-out attack. And that first attack, some of these weapons they use, and I think some of them were kind of accurate that the English were using to defend against this attack, because I think that it was very confusing. It looks like they're attacking the city, but they were actually attacking a defensive work outside of the city that the English controlled, but the English hadn't yet taken the city yet. Which was, it was kind of confusing, like the English are defending a castle, but they don't control the city. They just control this castle outside of the city.
Yeah, it's this fortress, I think Saint-Loup or something like that, right?
I think that this was so much, that this was a fun medieval siege scene in a movie where they're climbing up ladders, setting things on fire, and all sorts of, fun things. What was maybe one of your most fun moments from the siege?
Well, in the movie, of course, it's when the French are running away and she takes her horse and she jumps over the wooden spikes. I mean, that's how you do things. And then she pulls out her sword and starts hacking away at people. Now, again, like I said, before I saw this movie, I expected if this were made in 2015, she would be full Black Widow doing backflips. And when she thrusts her sword, she would stab four people at once, all in the throat lined up. So this movie isn't as bonkers as the one that was in my head before I saw it.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Now, I should mention here, this actually gets into a very big issue about the role of women in combat and what did it look like throughout history. There's legends like Boadicea or the Amazons or things like that. I mean, Boadicea is not a legend, but there's, of course, embellishment. Joan never used a sword. The most she used it was basically to hit prostitutes away in camps. She would mostly hold the standard and the flag to inspire troops. So that's what she did. Now, she did it, of course, very well, and she would lead charges. And there was one account at Joan's rehabilitation trial posthumously. Spoiler, Joan dies. It's also 600 years after the fact, so no surprise there. But somebody said that, "I swear that the English, 200 of whom had previously been sufficient to rout 800 or 1,000 of the Royal Army, the Royal French Army, from that moment became so powerless that 400 or 500 soldiers and men-at-arms could fight against what seemed to be the whole force of England." So she was really an inspirational force who would lead a charge and give courage to soldiers that had other times been so demoralized by years and years and even decades of defeat that it allowed them to get over the psychological hump and realize they were able to defeat English, who were, like you said, part of a very overextended supply line. And they were at an outpost. They couldn't really send reinforcements. So for her as a psychological figure, that was that's what she did in this role. Now, actually hacking down soldiers with her sword, she didn't do. But compared to what this movie could have been, you know what? I'm not too upset by that.
Yeah, I think that you're onto something, that this movie was the precursor to all of these other movies. It kind of set the stage, like with the Braveheart, with these bizarre weapons that Braveheart used. And they did a lot of that in this movie. Like, they had this device that they had put in front of the English put in front of their gate to prevent the French. And it was, he called it the porcupine, and they basically stuffed a whole bunch of arrows into this, I mean, for a lack of a better word, medieval device, about 100 arrows into this device. And then he presses a lever and all of the arrows shoot out of it. And everybody's, "Watch out for the porcupine."
Yeah, that.
And then they load it again and they shoot it. There's no porcupine. No porcupine ever existed in all of medieval warfare or any warfare before or after.
And I thought of Braveheart watching this, that, oh yeah, that, like, Braveheart was the big movie when this one was released. That when people thought of medieval-esque combat, that is what was in people's minds, because Braveheart was what, 94, 95? Won all these Academy Awards. So that's the movie that you're going to rip off, much in the way that when Kingdom of Heaven came out, it ripped off Lord of the Rings. So the Braveheart scene where they have these sharpened pikes that they raise to stab the cavalry as they come running, they're maybe trying to go for something like that, I guess. So that's what I thought of in the scene, too.
A lot of the things, too, where Joan, actually, she, in reality and in the movie, she gets shot at the Siege of Orléans by an English arrow in her leg. And, or no, she gets shot at the siege, she gets shot square in the chest through all of her armor and everything that she's wearing. And that was another thing that, that's a big part of the legend and the history, is that she went into combat in armor, which, it kind of, the timeline makes kind of not a lot of sense, because those works of armor that they wore in the High Middle Ages took months and months to construct, and that she had a perfectly tailored suit of armor so quickly, I kind of question that. But, you know, we'll leave that one for artistic license. But they really only show one English archer throughout the whole movie, and that was basically what the English did, was they had archers.
Yeah, that's why they won the Battle of Agincourt. And the longbowmen, that's what they're famous for. If you exhume skeletons, if that's your practice, of longbowmen, their right arm were sometimes a few inches longer for the years of training and practice that went into it. And aside to the armor that she wore, one thing the movie does accomplish well is she has the signature Joan of Arc haircut, which aside was fashionable in Paris in the 20s when women had the short haircut, as do the men. And it's historically accurate, but everyone looks ridiculous. I would like to say John Malkovich, too. He's got the sort of the mid-90s men's bowl haircut, except without the part on the front. So take the Backstreet Boys, except there's no part. It's just all the way around and shaved underneath. Historically accurate, looks ridiculous. And I think we'll get in, maybe we'll save this more for the heresy trial, but part of her, you know, wearing men's clothing or whatever. This is where things get messed up and your gender studies crowd will claim that Joan was bending gender norms and doing all this different stuff. Well, it's not like there's women's armor at this time. It's sort of like armor is armor. And partly there's gender roles, but there's also, there were sartorial laws in the medieval ages that based on your class, based on your profession, you had to wear certain types of clothing. I mean, this dies out by after you got out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, still stays in the Ottoman Empire well into the 19th century. But that's an element of it, too. And had her trial been run correctly, they would have said, well, due to the conditions she was in, it was OK for her to wear the clothing that she did. And Thomas Aquinas has exceptions for what clothing can people wear if the circumstances merit it, which for Joan's case, they would. But anyway, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So she's doing battle.
Yeah, so she's in this battle. She gets injured. They pray. All these great characters. One of those side characters that I didn't know much about. He was portrayed by Vincent Castle. He was in Eastern Promises. Tons of great movies. He's one of my favorite actors. He played Gilles de Rais, who he has a really interesting story too. I was interested in Vincent Castle, so I looked at the character he played. And Gilles de Rais was basically Joan's right-hand man throughout this entire whole part of her life. And he was the Marshal of France, which was the top general of France. So as high of a position as you can possibly go, pretty much without actually being the king. But he had an interesting afterlife after this as well, that he was convicted in the 1400s, I think around the 1450s, of being a serial killer. He's one of the first documented serial killers. And it seems like the scholars really argue back and forth again. He's another one who they said that he kind of got caught up in this whole post-Joan of Arc thing. But he wasn't convicted of being a serial killer by the English. This was long after the English were gone that he was brought down. But so he's convicted by a French court, by a French ecclesiastical court, of killing 100 children. And there's really not a lot of evidence to say that this was like a political setup or anything. A long time afterwards, in 1992, there was this whole thing where they tried to rehabilitate him in France. And the Supreme Court of France heard a case. I love it when they do these cases hundreds of years later, like an actual court will do this. Like the evidence is really great to weigh on this. And it's obvious that there's political elements to this. So the French in modern times have said, oh, no, this was all cooked up against him much after the fact. But scholars outside of the French sphere still say that he did it. So you can make your own choice on whether you think Gilles de Rais actually did it or not. But he's one of the famous, we kind of went off on a true crime tangent here, but that's what happens. Joan is able to lift the siege of Orléans, and that's like her major, major victory.
Yeah, this is something I think that the movie is interesting because it explains it in one sense correctly, that there's hesitation among military commanders of following her, which is true, but it doesn't really explain why would they follow her, because yes, she is an illiterate peasant girl. And Now, remember, I mean, this is firmly still in the Middle Ages. This is on the tail end of the Crusades, but Crusades are still going on, maybe not in the Holy Land, but against the Hussites or other people like that. And for Crusades, the mythology of it, the belief that God could equip different people, that God could give different signs, where in the First Crusade, when they're going to Jerusalem during the siege of Antioch, they find a holy relic that's buried because somebody has a vision that they saw one. And this is belief and affirmation that God should send them, that they should continue on their battle. Joan was sent to Orléans sort of as a medieval ordeal. So if God is behind her mission, then if he's not behind it, then she'll die. If he is behind it, then he'll live. And we get back to this in our other movie, El Cid. So it's strange, even at the time, it was strange for Joan to claim what she did and her to be involved in this way. But it made more sense in the context of the times. And there were things that happened in this age of the Crusades where people would claim for a vision from God. And the way that she explained her mission to others really took on the motif of a crusade against England. This wasn't just a fight among brethren for purely political means. It became not explicitly a holy war. I mean, the Pope or no one was offering indulgences for fighting at this time, but I'm sure that spirit was imparted to some of the troops and they were getting that meaning. And Joan was certainly embraced as somebody sent by God and explains a lot of her popular support. That's not really explained in the movie. And especially with how crazy and yelly she acts, she's not really an inspirational figure for the devout to rally around. So if there would have been a scene or two of, I don't know, someone going to like maybe pray in a church and they're praying to a holy relic that was brought from the Holy Land by a crusader, then at least kind of gives you a sense of this world where somebody like Joan made more sense than we're led to believe in this film.
Yeah, I think that ties into some. They set it up, and again, they made this kind of a crazy scene. It was a bit earlier, right after the Charles the VII scene, where she identifies him in the crowd, where they have to test her virginity, and they just make a really bizarro scene of like all these priests coming in and then nuns coming in, and it's kind of making like a mockery of the whole thing. But that was one of the key elements to how people at the time believed her, is that she really, somebody who was, I mean, I keep thinking, oh, she was so young, 17 years old, but like, you know, in the Middle Ages, she was prime marriage material, and she would have almost likely a peasant girl have been in the process of being married. But so that whole scene that Besson kind of makes a mockery of her being examined if she's pure or not was one of the key elements of why people believed her and understood her to have these visions.
Right. And she's also undergoes testing for her orthodoxy by clerics because, I mean, they had quality control back then. You can't just claim to hear messages from God, that alone in the Middle Ages. As we talked about in previous episodes, people weren't superstitious in the way they weren't ignorant. The way they understood the material and immaterial worlds connected is different than our modern understanding. But priests would know, okay, someone claims they're from God, we have to test them thoroughly to say that they have orthodox belief, because they had madness, they had the mentally ill back then as well. They didn't want another Peter the Hermit situation on their hands in the Crusades, where you have this folk person who rallies a bunch of the peasants and the rabble to his cause. They basically go and raid and ransack a bunch of towns on the way to the Holy Land before the knights are ready, and they get themselves all enslaved and captured. So you have to have quality control before you're going to give your official stamp of support behind someone who's claiming to receive divine visions.
Yeah, I think that that's maybe the part where Besson gets things flipped around. In medieval standards, if somebody, you know, a peasant girl who's illiterate steps up and says that she's hearing voices, they're going to automatically think that she's possessed by a demon. And there would have been an examination process to see if she was possessed by a demon or not. And this will get into the trial of Joan of Arc. These are not what we would generally think of as heresy trial, like you might think of from later times, where somebody says, "You're a witch." And, "Oh, yeah, she is a witch. She is a witch. All right." And then they toss her in the fire. A medieval heresy trial is about as exciting as a medical malpractice trial. If you've ever sat on a jury where there's hours and hours of cross-examination and direct examination, expert witness testimony, judges hearing motions and motions to dismiss. And these are, I mean, and there's people who study these. I mean, they make entire careers of studying these completely dry documents of legal text. And that's how a heresy trial was done in the Middle Ages.
Yeah. So, and your point being that someone who would be able to receive the support of the clergy, at least initially in her battles, if Joan were behaving historically the way she does in the movie, probably wouldn't pass. So she's very frantic. No. She's yelling all the time. She seems sure of her calling in the movie, but very early on, she gets other weird visions where Christ appears, but there's this stigmata thing and she has blood on her. So she seems to not understand what it is that's happening. That wouldn't be many points are in her favor. And when we get to discussing the heresy trial itself, that's where things do diverge strongly.
Yeah, so I think that's, we can kind of skim through because the movie skims through the next. There's a siege of Paris. Charles is eventually able to be coronated as King of France in Reims in France, which that's actually the traditional place that French kings are crowned. And there's also a really interesting story of how he was actually able to do that. And as the movie just skims over it, we shall skim over it as well. But he is coronated. And then the next thing, they kind of, again, they don't out and out say it, but it's Charles, through John Malkovich, kind of gives us that he's sick of Joan, and he sells out Joan to the English, and that's how Joan is captured by the English.
Yeah, you're not going to sell out a folk hero like that. And now it's true in a sense that she's not as useful to the crown once Charles is coronated. And because Charles is in a much stronger footing now, he could look at diplomacy. But Joan was doing different things at this time before her capture. She was thinking, well, there's a crusade going on. I think it was the Hussites. I guess I could join that or, you know, keep my holy mission going in a different direction. And she does want to continue things and keep fighting the French, and doesn't like that this is the motion that they're taking. But yeah, Charles, he's not just going to have her killed and like conveniently swept under the rug. So that's silly.
This is really the time too. The English, as much as they had reached a high watermark not too long before this, there's a lot of problems that they have. Logistically speaking, they have problems. They're having problems with their allies, with the Burgundians, all of their alliances. So they're very quickly receding to the north. So you can kind of see why Charles might, like you said, Joan, her usefulness is kind of becoming marginal now.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually she's caught by the Burgundians, and that's not exactly how they portray it in the movie. But one way or the other, she winds up in English hands, and they bring her to Rouen, which is in the north of France in Normandy. And that's where we have her good old-fashioned heresy trial.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
I think the movie, they also skim over this, like you said, but there's a few months period from after the Truce of England where before she's captured. This period is actually a time when the evidence used for canonization, she performs acts which are used to present that she was in fact a saint. So she was in a city in Lognes-sur-Marne, don't know how to pronounce it, but her and other women are praying over an infant who had passed away that it might return to life so it could receive the sacrament of baptism. And according to her posthumous trial testimony, they were granted the prayer and the child returned to life long enough to receive baptism. So a lot of the evidence for her to be canonized happens in her posthumous trial to rehabilitate her after she's declared a heretic. But in the movie, I don't even know how this time is for prayer. I think she probably yells, flips over tables. It's all kind of running together in my mind. And then she gets sold out.
This is the part where Bassan really, he makes this full press to say that she's just a schizophrenic.
Yes.
And that's where that weird scene with Dustin Hoffman comes in.
Yeah, so I think, so Dustin Hoffman, he's a character in the movie. He's not real. All the reviews and everything I read said that she's sort of a projection of Joan's conscience. But first, I mean, listeners, I'm not a very smart man. I don't typically get things right the first time. And I thought, are they trying to do a Last Temptation of Christ here where it's Satan tempting her? But no, they're starting to show that it's a projection of her conscience, or it's her doubts that she actually did receive a calling from God and it's only her imagination. But yeah, so that's the, I guess they're trying to show the inner turmoil. And Luc Besson is maybe taking the line of revisionist historians who said that Joan was brave, but she was schizophrenic. So that's where the voices came from. So this is the tack taken from The Messengers, ladies and gentlemen.
I hate to go on this sidetrack, but with Dustin Hoffman, they put him in historical movies. Like he was in the television show for the Medici, and he played Giuliano de Medici. He was the dad of one of the big Medici, and he was just so bad in it. How does this guy get cast in historical dramas when he does not act in any way historical? He doesn't even use a fake English accent or anything to legitimize himself.
Yeah, some characters were cast well. Others are a little bit confusing. A lot of the reviews, also people weren't over the top for Mila Jovovich as Joan. She was nominated for a Raspberry Award as Worst Actress. I don't know who else you would cast. Now, when I was trying to think, okay, women in the 90s were in their 20s. My brain first immediately went to Winona Ryder, because that's how you think of as Cassie in the 90s.
Yeah.
So I thought, no, that would actually be worse. Or, I don't know, maybe. I mean, innocent and doe-eyed, but thrown into circumstances that you don't quite understand. But you're making the best of it out of strong adherence to faith. No, I'm going to say it. Winona Ryder would have been better. I'm going to plant my flag. And Joan was also diminutive. She was only 5'2", and Mila Jovovich cast a larger presence, so she's far more believable in the Resident Evil series, Kicking Zombies. So I'm going to plant my flag there. Winona Ryder would have been a better Joan of Arc. So come at me, listeners, but that's my opinion.
I think they could have very easily done it, too, where I think Bassan would have ruined anybody in this one. When you're directing someone to act like a lunatic and scream constantly, I think that it was kind of baked into the movie that this was going to be a bad performance.
Yeah, maybe it's not possible. So grasping at straws here.
We can wrap up pretty quickly. The real trial of Joan, and pretty much the one portrayed in the movie, it's a complete show trial.
Right.
And the English had a heck of a time even trying to get any churchman who would sign on to it. I think they had said a lot of the canon lawyers would, they quit. They weren't going to participate in the sham. And at this point, a lot of the people who the English are employing for this are French, and they're seeing that the winds are starting to come around to France's side, and they back out. But they are actually able to get her convicted. She's burnt at the stake, and she's not burnt once. She's not burnt twice. They reburn her 3 times just to make sure she was dead. And that's pretty much that's that for Joan, 19 years old in 1431.
Yeah, this is a weird part for the trial where in the movie, they actually use lines from the historical record of what she says. So I thought that, number one, that was odd that they try to be really accurate there. And they also in the movie show glimpses of how sharp she was, which really comes out in the historical record, because at one point she's being cross-examined and a person asks her a question and she says that, well, she already answered that question a week ago. And the scribe says, well, no, you're mistaken. And so she challenges him to go to the court transcript, and they do, and they find out that Joan is correct. They try to set traps for her. One question is she asked her if she was or was not in God's grace. And the question is a trap, because if she said she was, then the clerics would pester her for claiming to know the mind of God. If she said that she wasn't, then she would condemn herself. So the way she works out this is, if I am not, may God bring me into it. If I am, and may God keep me in it. So that's another factor, too, that in her rehabilitation trial, they note that she has full control of her faculties when she's in a very stressful situation. When she was on the battlefield, she was calm and composed. That doesn't show the signs of a person being possessed. But like you said, doesn't help. She's convicted of 70 counts of sorcery, heresy, and prophesying and conjuring and divining. but it's reduced to only 12. So there you go. Instead of getting 10 burnings, it's reduced to 3 burnings. That's the mercy and clemency she receives in the Inquisition court.
And I think that my biggest problems with the movie is they don't portray an accurate Joan based on the primary documentation that we have of her. They don't portray her in that way. Somebody who's calm, collected, who obviously has some knowledge of canon law and of Orthodox Christian theology. She's not spouting, you know, I'm not running down Hus or anybody like that, but when they're saying things, he's saying things, it actually is not what things like he was saying was against the teaching of the Catholic Church in the 1400s. The things that Joan was saying were not, you know, so it's hard to say that she was a heretic, she was a lunatic, she was this, and this, because there's no evidence for that.
What the movie, I suppose, is trying to say is that the institution of the church was corrupt, but her and her devoutness transcended that. So at the end scene of the movie, the bishop won't hear her confession, even though she wants it before she's burned at the stake, because she won't recant the charges against her. And so her conscience, Dustin Hoffman again, receives her confession. So it's sort of like her acceptance of herself is she doesn't have to work through the mediation of the church. I think I'm trying harder to understand the themes of what this movie is saying than the movie itself did, trying to present what those themes were. So I shouldn't overexert myself. But it's one of those things where, not to bring in Star Wars, but like The Last Jedi, where it wants to subvert what you expect to happen, which subverting can be good. But it doesn't work when you subvert it into something more boring and less interesting than what you were expecting to happen anyway. So they're subverting the Joan you thought you knew, but they're subverting her into a crazier and less likable character. So congratulations.
And I think that that's what he was really going for, because like I could excuse if they were trying to put on modern gender identity and that sort of thing. They don't even try to do that at all. They're just saying Joan's a nuts, and basically medieval Christianity and medieval society's nuts, and that's that. There was a review from when it came out from Christianity Today, which is a magazine or something, but this, I thought that the first couple of lines from the review were so slicing and dicing of Besson that, I mean, this says it all. Director, so this is a quote, director Luc Besson attempts to prove what even the best prosecuting clerics of her day could not, that Joan was a demented, misled, hysterical, confused, and guilt-ridden phony. But even with the power and money of Sony and Gamal behind him, he is no more convincing than the Inquisitors of Rouen. I mean, that pretty much says it. Like, he's taking the English's argumentation, stretching it to its most absurd conclusions, and even he can't do it.
Right. So it's hard to know what he's going for or what is he trying to say with Joan. Because one other thing, too, in her interrogation with Dustin Hoffman, her conscience, he challenges her thinking, oh, these visions you thought you saw from God, where you see a sword lying in a battlefield and that's a sign that dropped from heaven. What if it could have, there are 1,000 normal things could have happened. A soldier could have dropped it. Someone could have been slain in combat and left there. Anything could have happened. But your mind chooses to rush to believe that it was from the Almighty. So you're prideful, you're arrogant, all these different things. It wasn't supernatural, which, again, goes against what Joan testified of herself and what others around her, that she didn't just see visions of clouds and saw a sword on the ground, but saw visions of archangels. And Charles, when she met Charles the Dauphine, recited a private prayer that he had made. So it sounds a lot like the narrative of one of the Crusades of how her career begins. So I don't know if they didn't want to tell the story of what traditionally happened, that, well, it's interesting, but it's stale, and I don't want to buffet the medieval church, so we're going to tell a different story, but they don't tell it in a good way. So it fails in whatever it is it's trying to do.
And we usually wrap these up with how we can just possibly scrape something together to make this movie better. And I think for me, The easiest way to make this movie a million times better is basically make Braveheart with Joan of Arc. Cool battle scenes, narrative arc. She's on top. Then she goes to the heresy trial. It's basically all they'd have to do is change some costumes and use Braveheart's script, and you've got an infinitely better movie.
So, Steve, a place where history nerds like you and I run into problems when we talk about movies, I think, as we say, well, they need to do XYZ to make it historically accurate. And we've already pointed out a lot of the inaccuracies, but Hollywood movies don't work that way. And sometimes you just have to accept that, okay, it is what it is. And I thought, well, I don't know, maybe just sort of get into the medieval world, make sense of why people would follow a 17 or 18 year old and just run with it. So listeners are going to hate this, but I thought, okay, what's a modern example of people basically following a child? I don't know, Greta Thunberg. that's great. Let's make her Greta Thunberg, which I think would make the movie far worse, but kind of scolding and hectoring, we don't want that. But to get a sense of why would people follow a child on a moral cause? Well, if she becomes, it's not so much she's a child, but she's a symbol of innocence who's kind of like seeing the purity of a higher calling and calling out the ills and wickedness of a society. So maybe if the movie kind of would have gotten more into the medieval world and you could understand the world of ordeals, and which I think El Cid actually did a really good job of. Okay, I'm going to put my life on the line for this cause. And if I don't die, then, you know, people can follow me for this. Oh, okay. And so other movies have done this much better. So maybe like the world of ordeals and just basically throwing your life on the line for something, and they wouldn't have gotten to that more, maybe better. And also, if her using a sword to hit prostitutes, kind of like who she was and the way that she wasn't a battlefield commander, and I can't stress that enough. When people talk about in the ancient world, were there women in combat? And all that I've seen, the answer is basically no, unless there was a siege going on and you were at your last readout, then women would pick up arms. That's true. Until you get into the age of firearms, that's really not a thing. There's cases like shield maidens, or they might argue about someone like a Boadicea, but there's even argument about how much shield maidens, the weapons they had, were they actually used in any way, or are they purely ceremonial? So I think like that really, to give her a sword in like attack people, I think in a way it actually diminishes her bravery, because to go out with a flag and to climb ladders, to try to overcome siege equipment, to rally at the front when she was by far the weakest person on the battlefield, unless there was someone who is mortally wounded, which I think speaks more to her bravery that she would do that and basically shame the army and rally them back into stuff there. So, I mean, it's just sort of like you have such a good story and we know that it's true and they're making it worse. So I don't know, like, what are they trying to accomplish by taking a really great, that's why we're talking about her 600 years later, because her story is so incredible. I guess it makes people think, well, it can't be true, but she has one of the most well-recorded trials. There's testimonies of dozens of people about her life. So she's one of the best recorded, best documented historical figures. So as much as we can know about someone's story, it is true. So like, what do you gain by making it worse? I don't get it. How do you make this movie better? Like, tell the story of Joan of Arc.
Yeah. You know, getting to what you were saying, all of these warriors around her, they've been doing this since they were six, seven years old. They've been training at being a knight, where Joan just shows up and she's swinging a sword around and actually killing people. It's absurd. And they kind of get to that point a little bit of what you were saying in the scene where Vincent Cassel playing Gilles de Vray, he's like standing in between Joan's going nuts and he's like standing between her and the walls of the castle. And the archer shoots him in the arm or in the back or something. And he's been shot by the arrow and he's like gritting his teeth to not show it so that he doesn't upset Joan. And more, if they had done more of stuff like that, it would have made the movie tremendously better, because you do get a little taste of like, was her real story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she shot multiple times. She shot in the leg at one scene, but she just like barely notices it because she's in a trance or a fugue state. Yeah, I mean, you were hit by projectiles all the time. If it's low velocity, you'll get pierced, but you would more likely die of infection than just by the trauma of something that's higher velocity, like a gunshot wound. But again, so this is how the movie is better, is had it come out 15 years later, it would be like Mulan or Black Widow or something, where she has a sword and she stabs four men through the throat at one time and she personally kills 300 people. Basically like the Kill Bill with the bride. I mean, that's at least heightened. It's obviously not trying to be anything. It's heightened violence. So Quentin Tarantino is obviously operating in a pure fantasy realm. But I could see a modern day like retelling of Joan of Arc basically doing that. So it could have been worse. That's one of my highest praises for this movie.
Ultimately, it's up to the listeners out there. Are you going to be on the Inquisitor side, mine, or are you on Scott's defense?
Yeah,
hopefully his defense is a little bit better than those of the clergy at Rouen, but it's ultimately up to you to decide.
Yeah, we really sold it well, haven't we?
Yeah, we sure have.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.